I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
On this week's episode of Trade Guys, we'll discuss China's rush into legacy chips and the state of e-commerce. All that and more on Trade Guys.
Good morning, Trade Guys. I hope you're both doing well, especially you, Bill, since last week.
I'm surviving. We were just having a discussion before we started. Is it, you know, am I sick because I'm old or am I just sick? Anyway, I'm getting better. So my voice, I hope, is a little bit better than it was last week when it was pretty raggedy. But
I wouldn't call it raggedy. I think it was sultry, Bill.
Nobody's called me sultry in 50 years, but okay.
This is how I keep on being your research associate. Anyways, let's begin with growing alarm from U.S. and allies about legacy chips and China. Apparently, China has accelerated a push into producing older generation semiconductors. They have been pouring billions into factories for these legacy chips, the ones that haven't been restricted. And senior officials are now growing increasingly concerned. For example, Gina Raimondo recently warned about a glut of chips that would come with those subsidies. So Trade Guys, can we start by discussing the reasoning behind the growing worries? What's at stake here?
I can do this with a bit of schadenfreude because we predicted this. The Chinese are following a playbook. What's interesting about it today is that for the last multiple weeks and actually months, we've been obsessing over the very high end of semiconductors, you know, the sub 14 nanometer made with very advanced tools. And we've talked about the export controls and the impact and all that. The much larger market is for legacy chips, which are things that are most basically above 14 nanometers and are made with tools that are widely available and technology that was developed probably at least 10 years ago. These are the things that the chips that go into your phone, they go into your car, they go into your toaster and refrigerator. They're the basic building blocks of a lot of, well, really anything that involves electronics these days. And they are, like a lot of things, subject in part because of what the Chinese are doing, subject to kind of boom and bust cycles, which has been a problem for the economy. During COVID, orders stopped coming in from them, particularly from the auto industry, which was shutting down at the peak of COVID. And so manufacturers started making, you know, other chips for other purposes. So when the recovery was quicker than expected, we had a shortage. All of a sudden, all these companies were back online demanding chips, and the chip manufacturers had turned their attention in other directions. So we went to a shortage. Now we are heading into a glut at the low end. At the high end, we still have shortages, and that's a whole different question. But in the legacy chip category, we're heading into a glut. And one of the reasons is the Chinese have once again followed their industrial policy playbook, which from my observation is this is inevitable in non-market economies. You're going to get excess investment and excess production always. Because credit is allocated by the government, it's not allocated by the market. And when the government decides something is important, they pour a lot of money into it. The Chinese did this with steel, they did it with aluminum, they did it with solar panels, they did it with wind turbines. They're going to do it with aircraft once they get one that will fly. And they're doing it with chips. They're planning to build 26 new fab plants. I think they allocated something like $350 billion for this. A number of years ago, this was pre-COVID. This is not a new development, and their articulated goal is to create global champions in this space. But they're doing it with massive subsidies, and the result is, first of all, that ultimately forces a lot of other people out of business. I mean, it even forces people out of business in China because only some companies get the subsidies, and the ones that get the subsidies do very, very well. And make a lot of money, and the ones that don't lose out, it forces companies in third countries out of business as well. You saw this in solar, you saw it in steel, aluminum, you saw it in wind, and you're probably going to see it in chips. It's more complicated this time around for a couple reasons. One, when the Chinese do it in a lower tech area where there's lots of producers, steel being an example, there's lots of victims. It's not just the American victims. everybody that makes steel becomes a victim. I think over a period of about 10 years, the Chinese more than doubled their steel capacity. It ended up, I think a few years ago, they have half of all the steel capacity in the world, more than half. And if you've got lots of victims, it's easier to try to put together a multilateral approach to deal with a problem. And there are standard tools for dealing with subsidies. And I mean, Donald Trump would be very happy. The standard tool is tariffs. Countervailing duties is what they're called. And they're put in place, WTO sanctioned, permitted, to offset the harm that's being done by the subsidy. We did this with steel and more or less knocked the Chinese out of our market directly. They went from the number one or number two importer to number 11 or 12 importer because we affixed a lot of dumping and subsidy duties to their steel. Of course, one of the consequences of that is they pushed the dump product into other countries. So there were other victims. With chips, it's going to be a little bit different because there aren't that many other countries that produce chips. So if you try to multilateralize this program and go to other countries and say, you should impose dumping duties too, and you should impose subsidy duties, the other countries are going to say, I don't have any producers. I don't have anybody being harmed. Why should I increase prices to my industries that use chips in order to make your companies, which are more expensive because they're not subsidized, at least not as much, make your companies more successful? So there are unilateral remedies, but getting a united front on this is going to be more difficult. One of the consequences of that, and this is the last point I'll make, is that there's a natural gravitation, and I'm waiting for the China hawks in the Congress to say this, and they'll be wrong, but they're going to say it anyway, is, well, the answer is export controls. We need to expand export controls over legacy chips in order to stick it to the Chinese. And the problem with that is that ship has sailed. The Chinese have the tools. They make the chips now. They make a significant market share of those chips now. This is a classic case of foreign availability. Putting export controls over those chips and over older tools is a classic case of closing the barn door after the horse has left. It'll be proposed, but it will not be the solution to the problem. And if we do it, what you're going to do is further kneecap our own industries by taking away, the revenue they get from selling those products to the Chinese. That hasn't happened yet. The administration hasn't done it. I think it's only a matter of time before some people in Congress propose it. I hope the administration will resist and focus on a better way to deal with the problem.
Yeah, Bill, I think you're right. That legacy chip problem is different in kind than steel or some of the other areas where there has been recent examples of extreme overcapacity. But overcapacity is kind of what you get with this level of subsidization. Now, I would say that when we see a legacy chip, this is such a fast-moving industry that what we're now calling legacy probably was state-of-the-art sometime in this century. Fewer than 20 years ago, it was a state-of-the-art chip. So this is a very fast-moving industry. It's one of the reasons it soaks up a lot of capital. Second, I think it's important to point out that we've seen this movie before in integrated circuits, and it's in the so-called DRAM chips, dynamic random access memory chips. These were, I think, invented probably the late 60s, early 70s. They became very prominent as a inexpensive storage device, but it's a specific kind of integrated circuit where a lot of producers piled in, and then the marginal benefits of a more faster or more modern chip tapered off. And so there was massive overcapacity. This happened to the company, a U.S. company, Micron, was in the business. So were companies in South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, elsewhere. And that whole section, to this day, I think DRAM chips are awesomely low margin. The marginal value of an investment dollar is return on investment is basically zero. It remains available at very low prices. Nobody makes any money. Everybody's unsatisfied with returns from the sector. So what we don't want to do is replicate this more broadly because it winds up hurting anybody who's a producer in the business. Finally, I think Bill made a point about state-directed capital and the consequences of it. And there's a reason, I think, that industrial policy and state-directed industrial subsidies fell out of favor in places like the United States and Europe, which is really ugly when it turns against you and you wind up wasting a lot of capital that markets would have allocated elsewhere that put your economy in better shape for the long run. So we don't have the extent of the problem that China does, but it's something, since we're in the industrial subsidy business again in a major way with the Biden administration, it's something to watch out for, that you can overdo this and sort of kill an industry with kindness, because the subsidies wind up creating or contributing to the overcapacity. It's a mess. I think, like any mess, it takes clear strategic thinking. We've got to decide what is important to us, and from a national security standpoint, control it. The answers may not be obvious. Some of them are, like, you've got to deal with Taiwan. It has centrality in the entire manufacturing orbit of integrated circuits. There's a lot of problems, but thinking clearly, I think, will help us here, not just throwing good money after bad.
And it's a particularly difficult problem, as we've seen in solar and elsewhere, because, you know, we don't control the Chinese economy. They control the Chinese economy, and they'll decide what to do. And they've set their course here. You know, they're investing massive amounts of money to subsidize this sector. And it's fine to say, as Scott and I have both said, that this is an economic mistake that they're making that may well come back to bite them. But in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of victims outside of China, primarily. And it's difficult to figure out exactly what to do. We can use dumping duties and the subsidy duties, countervailing duties, to effectively keep their chips out of our market. If we want to do that, we've done that before in the way we're kind of doing that with solar now. There's a big argument about that. But that doesn't alter the Chinese policy, and it just pushes the problem into other countries. It's really a global problem. I think when Ambassador Tai started talking to the Europeans about the green steel and aluminum agreement, she made the point that the problem was Chinese overcapacity, and it was a global problem. This is going to be a global problem too in chips, and there's going to be a lot of people suffering, and there's not really a clear answer to it. Running faster is part of it, staying competitive, but these chips are not at the cutting edge of competitiveness. You know, this is the great middle where there's a lot of demand, a lot of need, and will be, I think, for the foreseeable future. And we face the possibility of being outmaneuvered by massive amounts of subsidized chips, which will ultimately, in the long run, ultimately leave us dependent on China as a source, which is what's happened in wind turbines and steel. Solar panels. I'm gloomy about it. It's a serious problem. What I'm also gloomy about it is there's a monumental number of stupid solutions. And while we may have trouble figuring out the smart one, at least we ought to be able to avoid doing the stupid ones.
Fair point.
And Scott has alluded to this a little bit, but if there's a lot of stupid solutions, what's a potential smart solution to mitigate the problem? Is it more subsidies on our side?
Well, that's the road we're going down.
That's our current direction. I think it's a problem. I think we got to figure out what is the strategic or the national security need for control. Where is that point of fundamental advantage to the United States from a strategic standpoint? I don't know what that is.
It's a dilemma because there are lots of legacy chips in weapon systems. Secretary Raimondo commented on this in a Q&A session she did, and said when the Ukrainians are disassembling Russian weapon systems or ammunition that either didn't explode or they found fragments of, you know, they found chips that started out in refrigerators or, you know, automobiles because they were multi-purpose. So, yeah, I mean, if somebody's going to come in and say, well, these chips have military applications. Yes, they do have military applications. The Chinese have been making them for years. You know, that, as I said, that ship has sailed. I don't think export controls are the problem. Trying to develop a viable domestic source of supply, I think, is a noble goal. But as Scott pointed out, in this part of the sector, investment is risky, because the profit margin is low.
Your marginal return is zero on a dollar invested. So it's a very tough decision-making.
Well, thanks for the overview of trade, guys. Clearly, it's something that's going to be an ongoing story. Speaking of those, our second and last topic of the day, since we're tackling things that are so broad, I wanted to talk a little bit about the current state of the e-commerce. There are several points of debate that are relevant to the topic, both at home and abroad, and given how much that is going on, it's probably a good idea to touch base on everything happening. So on the home front, we have a few pieces of legislation that could alter the e-commerce landscape as we currently know it. State of Commerce approved a bill to create new rules for goods sold online, requiring that listings disclose a product's country of origin. And on a different note, lawmakers have proposed legislation to curtail de minimis, which allows goods valued under $800 to be imported free of duties and scrutiny. And that could have significant implications for e-commerce retailers. So guys, can you go over the content of different e-commerce bills on the table right now and how they would impact businesses and consumers?
Well, not to criticize the world's greatest deliberative body, but it seems to me that the Senate, at least this committee, made a hash of things when it comes to origin labeling. When you're looking at goods in trade, we have a harmonized tariff system that is managed principally by the U.S. International Trade Commission, but there are updates to the harmonized tariff schedule. And the reason it's called a harmonized tariff schedule and the rules are becoming a specific number in that schedule, it's harmonized because it's harmonized with our trading partners to the extent negotiations have gone on that long. So there's a customs authorities, every good that's imported into the United States has to have a customs classification. And the rules for that classification being authoritative are determined, and they're harmonized with our trading partners to a good part. There's also a U.S. requirement that the country of origin be marked on the package that is imported into the United States. So there are marking rules. Those marking rules are also subject to negotiation. There are many trade agreements which rely on the harmonized tariff system, and the rules by which a good becomes made in a certain country are, to an extent that we've been able to accomplish, fairly common across most trading partners. Now, there are exceptions, and this is a well-managed system, but one where importers take it quite seriously. You mark your goods according to their origin. There are occasionally areas of trade or commerce where there's an exemption from marking. I know one specific is coffee, tea, and spices. Because they have many, many origins and they have small packages, there was an agreement and it passed it became law that there's an exemption from marking the country of origin on those products. Having said that, most products do come and are required by U.S. law to be marked. Now, whether it's displayed to the consumer in online advertising is a separate matter. There's also the entirely separate issue of the claim made in USA. Made in USA has been determined over the years to not be a statement of a good's origin from a customs classification, but rather a marketing claim. And like most marketing claims, it winds up falling under the regulatory authority of the Federal Trade Commission. So the FTC, in fact, has recently promulgated new rules as recently as 2021 regarding made in USA. And so it's a separate area of concern. It's a separate agency that does it. And because it is considered a marketing claim and not a statement of origin. There are lots of goods which can have a U.S. origin in terms of the last place a substantial transformation was made as a matter of customs law and practice that do not qualify for made in USA because made in USA is against a separate standard. So if I were to advise the Senate Commerce Committee of resuming this bill falls apart at some stage, is to go back and think about these things separately. The FTC actually does have authority to regulate and recent rulemaking on made in USA, if that's the concern, versus the much broader and much more complicated topic of customs classification and rules of origin.
You know, as a Hill alumnus, I can't help but be a bit cynical about this latter point. There's an inside baseball reason for this, too. This bill, if the bill had made CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, the enforcement agent for this, the bill would have been referred to the Finance Committee. The senators that authored the bill are not on the Finance Committee. By making the enforcement agent the Federal Trade Commission, the bill was referred to the Commerce Committee. Senators who authored the bill are on the Commerce Committee. So this was something that they did in order to ensure that they got control over the bill's progress. You can make an elegant justification for that. Scott just did that up to a point, but I think it probably had more to do with you know, who gets control in the community jurisdiction process. The bill is designed to deal with what I think is a legitimate problem, and that, and Scott alluded to it, which is sort of online labeling. If you buy a product and you go to the grocery store and buy a bottle of something, and you look down through the label, if it was not made in the United States, it will tell you where it was made. And that's a decision, a distinction that is made according to the customs rules that Scott just described. If you go online to buy the same thing, the screen that you are going to be looking at and the product you're going to be looking at could even be the same product, will not necessarily show you that and will not necessarily reveal what the country of origin was. And I think the authors of the bill believe that the result is that people end up buying cheap, shoddy stuff over the internet thinking that it's something else. And then when they get it, they discover that it's not. And that if we had country of origin labeling, people wouldn't do that. They'd go for the American product. I kind of sympathize with the point. I mean, in a sense, there's a basic logic that if online sales ought to be subject to the same rules as in-store sales when it comes to something like this. So I don't have any inherent problem with saying if you're in the online business, you ought to provide country of origin just as if your item were being sold in a physical store. I'm not sure that doing that will have the effect that the authors want. You know, people tend to be motivated by factors other than country of origin when they buy. When you do a poll, people will tell you they care and that they want to buy American, but then they all go out and buy imported products, including automobiles. So I'm not sure that, I mean, this is sort of a case of cognitive dissonance. People say one thing and do another and apparently can believe two things at the same time. Like buying American is good, but in my life, I'm going to buy foreign because it suits me better. So it's not a terrible idea. I don't think it'll have the effect that the authors intend. The de minimis issue is a little bit different, and we've discussed that before. And there are different bills on that. One would, the one we've talked about in the past was Mr. Blumenauer's, that would basically deny the treatment to China and a couple other countries. That made it through the House in the context of, I think it was the CHIPS Act last year, only to have the entire trade title get dropped. I think he'll try again, and there will be some variation. It probably will make it through the House again. The Senate bill, which is Senator Cassidy's bill, I think is a little bit different and probably much more violative of the WTO rules, because it proposes a reciprocal approach. That is, we would have a de minimis requirement that matches the de minimis requirement of the exporting country. So if China's de minimis is $50, we would attach a $50 de minimis requirement to Chinese imports. If France's were $300, we would make it $300 for French imports, and so on. My impression is that from the WTO standpoint, that's a big no-no, because it's differential treatment, and you're treating different products differently. For the French, it would be, this is hypothetical, you know, for the French, it's $300 for everybody. For the Chinese, it's $50 for everybody. So they're consistent with the rules. If the Americans put in a rule that says it's going to be $300 for the French, it's going to be $50 for the Chinese, it's going to be $100 for the Japanese, it's going to be $800 for the Canadians, and that's when you get into WTO trouble. And it's when you get into an enormous amount of confusion on the part of freight forwarders and by and large, are not in the de minimis business, but people that are in the de minimis business, it creates a lot of confusion because you're going to have a multiplicity of rules that they're going to have to adhere to. So I don't see that one making it across the finish line. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody like Blumenauer's does.
Well, this is an area where what we're talking about here is the change in de minimis. It used to be $200 that a goods imported with a value, the shipment value is under $200. They would be not subject to customs and scrutiny. And that was raised to $800 in 2016, I guess. It was a bill that passed both houses in 2015 and was signed in 2016. So that was roughly the date of the change. And so the United States now has a relatively high de minimis versus other trading partners. But my point would be, first of all, we chose that. We chose it relatively recently and by a fairly wide margin. The conference report, this was the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act, passed the 114th Congress, but the Senate passed the conference report 75-20. The House passed 256-158. Republican House, Republican Senate, President Obama signed the bill. So this was a bipartisan effort. It was fairly popular at the time. And most importantly, that increase in de minimis was part of a system. That system being to help Customs and Border Protection have the tools they needed to focus enforcement on the highest risk areas. And so it was a risk management system that was set up, including automated entry. Now, I would note with interest that when it almost never gets mentioned in any of the reporting on it, is that there was a pilot program with 9 firms put in place by the customs to see how this worked and how to use it, use the tools and use electronic entry as a way to manage risk more effectively. Customs thinks that test was very successful, and in fact, has recently expanded it after testing some 380 million shipments in the pilot program. In February of this year, they expanded this pilot program to lots and lots of shippers. So they think this is working, and $800 has a lot of support, particularly for online sellers, not for the reasons you might suspect. It's mostly a U.S.-based online seller who has a foreign customer and needs to handle returns. I mentioned returns because no one does. Returns are a normal part of any retail operation. And if you make returns too difficult, that is, you have a foreign customer who has to go through 43 hoops with their own customs authorities to just return a good that doesn't fit properly or isn't exactly what they wanted, you'll lose the customer. And so a lot of online sales rely on a de minimis that is high enough to streamline the return process for that foreign customer. So there's a lot to this in terms of who benefits from it. As we've talked before, de minimis didn't create fast fashion. Fast fashion just started to use it. And so what? Okay, that's the way markets work. But more importantly, this was put in place with strong congressional support to improve customs risk management. And customs appears to think that's what it is. So for me, the best thing to do not next is have an oversight hearing and let's get the facts out, and maybe less worry will be part of the system when there are more facts.
Thanks, Scott. So all that is on the domestic front, but there is also movement on the multilateral front. What WTO members at MC12 agreed to intensify discussions on the scope and definition of the e-commerce moratorium. I suspect we're going to talk about this more when we get closer to MC13, as apparently some countries like India, Indonesia, and South Africa are threatening to block another extension. So can you tell us a bit about the moratorium and how it's benefited e-commerce retailers so far?
I just say first, for the non-nerds out there, MC12 refers to Ministerial Conference number 12 at the WTO, which was last year. MC13 is Ministerial Conference next February, which is going to be in Abu Dhabi. This goes back a long way. It goes back into the 90s when countries decided, in order to promote internet transactions, in order to promote digital trade, they would put a moratorium on taxing those transactions. And everybody agreed to that, but they agreed to it temporarily, which has meant that each ministerial agreement, each ministerial meeting, it comes up, it expires and comes up for renewal. It has become increasingly controversial as the years have gone on. And it's an interesting case because within governments, it's kind of a debate between the revenue authorities who smell money and other people in the government who are interested in the broader policy. You know, if you're the head of your country's Internal Revenue Service, your chief tax person, you think this is a huge untaxed thing. You know, people are buying all this stuff on the internet. We could put a 1% or 2% tax on all those transactions and add a pile of revenue to our budget. You know, you can see them drooling at the prospect. But that's if you're a taxing authority. If you think about it from a policy standpoint of view, it's actually Ronald Reagan used to talk about this. And when you say it's very simple, you know, if you want more of something, you subsidize it. If you want less of something, you tax it. And there's a lot of truth to that. You know, if you're going to tax it, what you're going to get is less of it. So if you're going to tax digital commerce, what that means is you're going to get less digital commerce. And that has a lot of implications that I think some of the proponents of getting rid of the moratorium, which are primarily India and South Africa and I think Indonesia and a couple others, I'm not sure they thought through. The biggest victim will generally be small and medium-sized enterprises who have begun to grow by selling on the internet. Because it's one, you know, because they're not Lockheed Martin, they're not Boeing, they're not Walmart, and they are not going to build branches of their physical location in other countries. They're little guys, but you could sell, you can be a little guy and still on the internet. When I was working for Senator Rockefeller years ago, one of the things, interesting things that actually his wife, Sharon Rockefeller, did was get involved with a quilting cooperative in West Virginia. And this was a bunch of ladies that every week got together and they made quilts. I mean, think West Virginia quilts, it's kind of fits. And what the cooperative ended up doing was figuring out they could sell their quilts online. And that enormously multiplied their market. You know, and then it helped. It also helps logistics companies, because if you're going to sell a quilt to in London, you know, you got to negotiate with DHL, UPS, FedEx to, you know, make the arrangements. So there's this whole booming area of commerce, which right now is not taxed. If you tax it, you're going to make it much more difficult, particularly for the small people, to continue to use it. And people haven't really thought about that. The revenue authorities think about it, and to the extent that the, you know, the tax ministers, the treasury finance ministers drive the train in the country, they may be able to dictate policy. The past couple times, it's been renewed only because there is another moratorium that was all, that also has expired at the same time. And that moratorium was on what are called filing non-violation complaints, which is a category of complaints where you, where you're allowed to assert that you're, the benefits due you as a WTO member have been denied to you, but you can't identify a specific rule that the offending country broke. So it's a non-violation violation. And the member states, the members of the WTO agreed to put a moratorium and filing those cases as well. That was a big benefit to India, because India would have been a target of a lot of those cases. So India liked that moratorium. India doesn't like the e-commerce moratorium. They would like to tax e-commerce transactions. So the deal that has been cut up until the last time was a trade. The developed countries that have the biggest stake in e-commerce will let the non-violation moratorium continue if you guys let the e-commerce moratorium continue. And the Indians and South Africans reluctantly went along. That deal was broken in the last time around when actually the USGR, I think, made a large mistake. It let the non-violation moratorium be extended, I think indefinitely, without insisting on a parallel agreement on e-commerce. In the end, they got the e-commerce moratorium extended through next February, but it's going to come back up, and this time will be hard fought. First of all, I don't think we have the leverage of the other moratorium to fall back on, and there are more countries that are spilling the money here and want to impose the taxes. So I'm very nervous about this. The consequences will be to slow down digitization. It'll be to slow down digital trade. That'll hurt a lot of our companies. But more importantly, it'll hurt a lot of SMEs in developing countries.
Yeah, this was easy to start because nobody had any revenue from e-commerce when the original moratorium went into place. So that was the easy part. And I agree with Bill, the pairing had worked effectively over the years. But the fact that this is temporary is just, once again, evidence of the absence of a round of trade agreements that would allow for the permanent extension of this and other useful features. So it's the fact that we haven't completed any real multilateral comprehensive negotiations where this would have been a topic and thrown into the mix, and there'd have been permanent rules on it. We're not very good at doing that anymore, and certainly haven't done it in now close to 30 years.
Thanks, Trade Guys. We're going into penalty time, but I appreciate us tackling these two topics, and I'll see you guys next week.
On to next week.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to The Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.